This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is Mary McConnell. This is the first hour of USA Today. It's a Monday. It's the 20th of May, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. In this hour, I'm going to read the top news stories from USA Today. And we're going to begin with telling USA's story. Historic landmarks mark competing visions of nations past. Lauren Villagran, Deborah Barfield Berry, Trevor Hughes, and Terry Collins write this again for USA Today. A warm wind blew through the old farmworker camp Saturday as Victor Rita, his voice catching, announced that the crumbling adobe buildings around him had finally been designated a National Historic Landmark. It had taken 10 years of paperwork, bureaucratic wrangling, and persistence for federal officials to formally recognize a site where hundreds of thousands of Mexican men were recruited into the United States beginning in World War II to work on farms. At Rio Vista, hiring bosses groped their muscles, examined their hands for calluses that would prove that they knew hard labor, and deloused them with toxic pesticide DDT. The Braquero program, named for the Spanish word for manual laborer, laid the groundwork for the migrant labor pipeline into the U.S. that still exists today. As recreation director of the community center at Rio Vista, Rita led the local effort to get federal recognition before the buildings buckled further in the desert winds and monsoon rains. But now National Park Service Protection will help tell the story of the Braqueros and the millions of Mexican-Americans who can trace their past to what some have called an Ellis Island in the Southwest. I've seen our culture and heritage and stories either get lost or muddied, says Rita, whose grandfather and father were migrant farm workers. Unfortunately, our history books don't necessarily share the whole picture. With its new historic landmark designation, Rio Vista became part of a sprawling but quiet effort to reshape how America's past gets told. This election year provides two competing visions of our nation's history, one based on tales of glory and exceptionalism, and the other more reflective of the stories told around a wider range of family dinner tables. There are 2,635 National Historic Landmarks in the United States. That's according to the Park Service, which is in charge of naming landmarks, as well as providing some grants, technical advice, and support to the sites, though it does not own or run most of them. As of 2022, the agency listed just 40 landmarks directly related to the heritage of Latinos, Asian Americans, and Pacific Islanders, the LGBTQ plus community, and women. Since then, capitalizing on years of legwork and community organizing by people like Rita, the Park Service, under President Joe Biden, has announced millions in spending to tell a broader variety of American stories. To recognize the history of African Americans, the Park Service recently launched a study to add lynching sites in Tennessee and Ohio stop on the Underground Railroad and in Illinois' exhibition on the role Pullman porters played in creating the black middle class. Just last month, the Park Service announced more than $23 million in grants as part of its Historic Preservation Fund's African American Civil Rights. It is also honoring Asian American history at a detention camp in Colorado, where thousands of U.S. citizens of Japanese descent were locked up during World War II. This month, the Park Service expanded a scenic 11-mile-long ridgeline to a national monument considered sacred to National American tribes in Northern California. But the federal efforts come as dozens of states, including Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma, have adopted or proposed measures that limit how Black, Latino, or LGBTQ plus history is taught, or that restrict the use of some books. Supporters of the so-called anti-woke laws, such measures will prohibit teaching divisive issues in public schools and blaming current generations for past injustices, such as slavery. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for the president, has emphasized a celebratory vision of America's past rather than one that highlights periods of failure and shame. If reelected in November, he intends to resume a plan he laid out during his first term to build a national garden of American heroes, says Caroline Leavitt, the campaign's national press secretary. It would include statues of the greatest Americans who ever lived, from George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to Frederick Douglass and Clara Barton to Rosa Parks, Elvis Presley, Billie Holiday, Vince Lombardi, and more than 200 others, she said via email. As he did for 4 years, President Trump will seek to preserve our historic sites and landmarks for all Americans so that citizens of all backgrounds can learn about and appreciate our great American story, she said, adding that the garden would be completed in time for America's 250th birthday, which will happen on July the 4th, 2026, to help our country be proud and united. Until recently, landmarks have been mostly bipartisan efforts. Jason Williams, who is an associate professor of justice studies at Montclair State University in New Jersey, said he wouldn't be surprised if the current focus on these landmarks becomes a political issue once more for people when they learn about it. I can see how this initiative by the National Park Service could be picked up as a political football by the GOP, mainly because of what we've been seeing lately in terms of their disdain for DEI, diversity initiatives, and cultural pluralism, he said. It's important for all Americans to see themselves and their histories, that and the country's landmarks. Shannon Estonis, who oversees the Interior Department's National Park Service, told USA Today. We have to be able to confront those stories and interpret them and put them in front of future generations so that they understand all of the chapters of our nation's history, she said. Black history is American history. Native American history is American history. This is all part of the story of our nation. And historic landmarks, she said, are the perfect place to tell and hear those stories. You can read and you should read history in books. And you should go to museums, and you should do all those things. But the Park Service invites us to come and stand where it happened. Here are some places the National Park Service is preserving. Many braqueros took what they endured at Rio Vista to the grave. Few are still left to tell their stories. Jose Maria Rodriguez was an eager 19-year-old following his father's footsteps when he left Mexico to pick cotton and cantaloupes in Texas back in 1964. His first stop in the U.S. was Rio Vista. Like anything, it was hard, Rodriguez, who is now 80, said, recalling the melon fields. You carried a sack over your shoulder across your chest. You picked them and put them in the bag. It was really, really heavy. Rodriguez, fit and chipper, returns 5 days a week to the old camp to keep company with the fellow elders, eat lunch, and play rounds of a bingo game called Loteria. Community-focused preservation plans for the historic landmark site also include a public library, health clinic, and a new Braquero Museum. Yolanda Chavez Levia, Rio Vista's lead historian, said an unknown number, possibly millions of Americans, who traced their roots to Mexico, had a braquero in their family. As Latinos become more of the population, we don't know what our place in history has been, she said. That the federal government is doing this and that Park Service is doing this for indigenous people, for Latino people, for African American people, it is so important, not just for the people of color, for everybody to learn that history. Detainees and liberators. Mitch Hama's father was locked up at Amache as a child, along with his father's two siblings and their parents. None of the detainees was credibly accused of any specific crime or received legal due process, but they were all nonetheless forced to sell or give up their homes and businesses over fears that they might sympathize with Japan following the Pearl Harbor attack. Most endured long train rides to hastily constructed camps like the one in Granada, Colorado, where they were forced to live in cramped condition for several years during the war. Many military-aged men from the campus volunteered for the front lines of the war, joining the segregated 3,000-man 442nd Regimental Combat Team that became one of the most decorated units of the war. In 3 years, 31 Amachi men were killed in combat, and the unit overall received 21 Medals of Honor and nearly 10,000 Purple Hearts. Its members also helped liberate the Nazi Dachau death camp. For many years, the sole federal site dedicated to telling this story was Manzanar National Historic Site in Eastern California, which is near Death Valley. It was better than nothing, but still isolating and constraining that part of history, Homa said. Although some high school classes may mention the internment camps, few learn the details or explore the parallels between places like Amachi and the German-run concentration camps, where millions of Jewish people were locked up and killed during the war. Homa's grandfather died of a heart attack in Amachi at the age of 44. Before his detention, he had been a well-respected Los Angeles dentist with actress Shirley Temple among his clients. When he was sent to the camp, he was forced to sell everything to white buyers for pennies on the dollar. Several other sites later received presidential designations as national historical sites, but Amachi in 2022 became the first since Manzanar to receive a congressional approval as a national historic site. A deeply divided Congress found common cause in preserving Amachi. The House vote to approve the measure was 416-2 and unanimous in the Senate. Homa said he and other Japanese Americans wanted Amachi to go through the congressional process to help ensure elected officials were on the record in support. So yes, there is a change in the landscape, Homa said. This is part of the telling of America's underrepresented story. Protecting sacred land. The wildflower superbloom along Northern California's Inner Coast Range is a visual representation of the joy members of the Yoka De Wintem Nation feel about the recent expansion of the Berryessa Snow National Monument. Everybody is smiling, Tribal Chairman Anthony Roberts said. We've cared for this sacred land for countless generations. This means a lot to us. The expansion, in the works for almost a decade, adds nearly 14,000 acres of federal land to the already 330,000-acre monument. The tribe, as well as other indigenous nations, including the Quetzal De Wintem and the Quetzal De Band of Wintem Indians, envision preserving an old trade route, as well as improving a recreational trail to attract hikers, sightseers, and bikers from San Francisco to Sacramento. Yoka De Wintem treasurer Leland Kinter said a key tribal goal is reintroducing the endangered California condor to the area. Moluk Layuk, the new name of the park's scenic ridge, means condor ridge in their native language of Potawatomi, he said. The condor plays an important role in our religion, in our regalia, and our ceremonial dances, Kinter said. It will help give us further respect for our history. It's a story that America needs. For Helen Hart, the artifacts at the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site in Washington, D.C., where she's a ranger, tells a story about his mission to make sure history doesn't repeat itself. He's trying to talk to us, says Hart. Douglass, who became an abolitionist after escaping from slavery, moved to Washington in the 1870s. He intentionally bought a house in a whites-only neighborhood at a high elevation. From his front porch, he can see the places where decisions are being made that are going to affect untold billions into the future, says Kevin Bryant, another ranger. 85 steps lead up to the Douglass House, where visitors can see the Washington Monument and the U.S. Capitol. Douglas spent the last 18 years of his life here, and about 50,000 people a year visit, peeking in the parlor where Douglas once met with visitors and peering into the office where he sat at his desk and crafted his famous speeches. With African American history under attack, it's particularly important that sites like Douglas's house are preserved, said Sylvia Quinton, who is president of the Frederick Douglass Memorial and Historical Association. Protecting our history through the federal government is the surest way to ensure that our history is not erased, she said. Next up, an article entitled, Trump Set to Pivot Following Verdict. NRA speech shows he's preparing for the outcome. David Jackson writes this article, again for USA Today. Facing a week in which a New York jury could decide his legal fate, former President Donald Trump is busy lobbying voters to stick with him no matter what the justice system does. This is their form of rigging the election, Trump told members of the National Rifle Association late Saturday while pledging to block gun control if he is sent back to the White House. Trump's NRA speech, which also touched on the challenging issue of abortion, heralded what could be a pivotal week. Prosecutors and defense attorneys in the New York hush money trial against him could make final arguments to the jury as early as Tuesday. The case then goes to the jury, and his decision could have a seismic effect on the 2024 race between Trump and incumbent President Joe Biden. Trump is already the first former president in U.S. history to face a criminal indictment, and a potential conviction would go far beyond anything that's happened before in American politics. Trump's counter events. Seeking to counter any bad legal news, the Trump campaign is lining up campaign events for the end of the week. Trump's schedule includes an economy and inflation speech in New York City that's going to happen on Thursday, and an address to the Libertarian Party convention in Washington, D.C. that's slated for Saturday. While emphasizing general campaign issues such as the cost of living and opposition to Biden, and specific issues such as gun rights, Trump is also making a basic claim about the legal issues against him. They are all politically motivated. I'm able to speak to the people and the people understand it, Trump told a supportive crowd at the NRA. He also complained in his remarks about the gag order that's pending against him in the hush money case that has already resulted in $10,000 in fines and a threat of jail time for future violations. NRA members ponder a verdict. As NRA members mingled among gun industry exhibits at the Cavernous Convention Center, they expressed confidence that Trump would block any gun control legislation if he were to regain the presidency. Some supporters were less confident about the hush money trial, especially about whether a guilty verdict might hurt Trump in the general election against Biden. I would stick with him, but I think it could make a difference in the election, said Devin Fedrick, 29. He's a salesman from McKinney, Texas. People on the fence may lean the other way because they don't like to elect a convicted person. NRI members also said an acquittal or a hung jury would propel Trump to victory. I don't think they're going to convict him, said Kimberly Carmines, 57, a financial manager from Arlington, Texas. I think it's political completely. Others said Trump would survive a guilty verdict because voters believe his protests of the legal system. Timothy Pate, 58, a heavy equipment operator who traveled to the NRA convention from Paris, Texas, said he's going to come out a winner on this thing either way. Amid marketers hawking hunting gear and raffles for high-quality guns, NRA members said they certainly don't blame Trump for being outspoken about his legal troubles. Beverly Vinlarik, 78, a retired teacher from Texas, said Trump may have a little mouth on him. But you know what? I would have a bigger mouth if I were him. I'd be fighting mad. In New York, Trump is accused of campaign finance law violations during the 2016 election regarding a hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Three other cases are pending against Trump. One involves the handling of classified documents. Two others concerned alleged attempts to steal the 2020 election from Biden, events that led to the insurrection of January 6, 2021. At the NRA convention, Murray Miles, 65, a retiree from Fort Worth, said the justice system has turned a billionaire into a martyr, with Republican voters at least. The big question is how independents react, he said. They're the ones who decide the elections. Trump promotes gun rights. While denigrating the justice system, Trump is also appealing to his conservative base by stressing issues important to them, like gun rights. Like Trump, the NRI has had legal troubles. In February, a New York jury found the NRA liable in a civil fraud case over the organization's questionable spending. Wayne Lapierre, the organization's longtime leader, stepped down. In his speech, Trump did not reference the NRA's internal problems, but he did say that their voter turnout in recent elections has not been up to par. "We've got to get the gun owners out to vote," Trump said. During the weekend, the NRA's Political Victory Fund formally endorsed Trump, saying the Second Amendment is at stake in the upcoming election. Politically toxic agenda. Democrats said voters have turned on gun groups because of their opposition to efforts to get guns off the streets, even in the wake of a string of mass shootings at schools, offices, and places of worship. The Biden campaign put out a statement from Vice President Kamala Harris, who said that she and Biden will continue to take on the gun lobby to keep America safe, while Donald Trump will continue to sacrifice our kids and communities' safety to keep these special interests happy. End of quote. Gun safety groups denounced Trump's NRA appearance. John Feinblatt, president of Every Town for Gun Safety, said that Trump once again made it clear that he is all in on the NRA's politically toxic agenda of undoing the life-saving progress we've made on gun safety under President Biden. Democrats are confident that, like abortion rights, their agenda on guns is popular with independent voters. While outlining his agenda on gun rights, immigration, law and order, and foreign affairs, Trump also spoke with the NRA about another politically sensitive social issue, that being abortion. The former president repeated his stance that states should set abortion policy, not the federal government. That position has brought pushback from social conservatives and Trump supporters who want a federal ban on abortion. Trump has a campaign event scheduled for Thursday in the Bronx borough of New York. On Saturday, Trump is scheduled to address a political convention, one sponsored by the Libertarian Party in Washington, D.C. Continuing with USA Today, this article is entitled, 1938 Law is Keeping Best Sunscreens in the World from Reaching America. Michael Scuturo writes this, again, for USA Today. When Texas dermatologist Adwali or Aide Edmondson sees people spritzing sunscreen as if it's cologne, he wants to intervene. "My wife says I shouldn't," he said, "even though most people rarely use enough sunscreen. At issue is not just whether people are using enough sunscreen, but what ingredients are in it." Skin cancer is the most common cancer in America. 1 in 5 people will develop it by age 70. Though treatment success rates are excellent, every hour at least 2 Americans die of skin cancer. The disease costs the healthcare system $8.9 billion a year, that according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And unlike many other cancers, most forms of skin cancer can largely be prevented. But the Food and Drug Administration has not yet approved chemical filters that are used in countries such as Japan, South Korea, and France. In particular, bimotrizinol is the bedrock ingredient in nearly all European and Asian sunscreens. Although American sunscreens labeled broad spectrum should, in theory, block the UVA light that penetrates more deeply and causes up to 90% of skin aging, some studies have shown they fail to meet the European Union's higher standards. It looks like a number of these newer chemicals have a better safety profile in addition to better UVA protection, said David Andrews, who's the deputy director of the Environmental Working Group. We have asked the FDA to consider allowing market access. The FDA is hamstrung by a 1938 law that requires sunscreens to be tested on animals and classified as drugs rather than as cosmetics, as they are in much of the world. So, Americans are not likely to get better sunscreens this summer or even next. Sunscreen makers say the requirement is unfair because companies submitted safety data on the newer sunscreen chemicals to EU authorities some 20 years ago. It goes back to sunscreens being classified as over-the-counter drugs, says Carl De Roos, a senior manager at DSM Firmenich, a Switzerland-based marketer of sunscreen chemicals. It's really about giving the U.S. consumer something that the rest of the world already has. The FDA defends its review process as a way to ensure the safety of products that many people use daily rather than just a few times a year at the beach. Many Americans today rely on sunscreens as a key part of their skin cancer prevention strategy, which makes satisfactory evidence of both safety and effectiveness of these products critical for public health, Sherry Duval Jones, an FDA spokesperson, wrote in an email. DeRue said people aren't dying from using sunscreen, they're dying from melanoma. Physical versus chemical. While complicating matters, a heavy dose of misinformation has permeated the sunscreen debate. Some people question the safety of sunscreens sold in the United States, which they deride as chemical sunscreens. These opponents prefer physical or mineral sunscreens, such as zinc oxide, even though all sunscreen ingredients are chemicals. It's an artificial categorization, said E. Dennis Bashaw, a retired FDA official who ran the agency's clinical pharmacology division that studies sunscreens. Such concerns were partly fed by the FDA itself after it published a study that said some sunscreen ingredients had been found in trace amounts in human bloodstreams. When the FDA said in 2019, and then again 2 years later, that older sunscreen ingredients needed to be studied more to see if they were safe, sunscreen opponents saw an opening, says Nadim Stath, president of Alpha Research and Development, which imports chemicals used in cosmetics. That's why we have extreme groups and people who aren't well informed thinking that something penetrating the skin is the end of the world, he said. Anything you put on your skin or eat is absorbed. Edmondson, the Texas dermatologist, said some sunscreen ingredients have been used for 30 years without any population-level evidence that they have harmed anybody. The issue for me isn't the safety of the sunscreens we have, he said. It's that some of the chemical sunscreens aren't as broad spectrum as they could be, meaning they do not block UVA as well. This could be alleviated by the FDA allowing new ingredients. DeRosa's company, DSM Firmenich, has spent the past 20 years trying to gain approval for bimotrizinol. DeRue said the process has cost about $18 million and advanced only fitfully despite attempts by Congress in 2014 and 2020 to speed along applications for new UV filters. It is the only company currently seeking to have a new over-the-counter sunscreen ingredient approved in the United States. Steven Goldberg, who's a retired vice president at BASF Corporation, that's a company that makes sunscreen chemicals, said companies are wary of the FDA process because of the cost and their fear that additional animal testing could ignite a consumer backlash in their European Union, which bans animal testing of cosmetics, including sunscreen. The companies are asking Congress to change the testing requirements before they take steps to enter the U.S. marketplace. Now, in a rare example of bipartisanship last summer, Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, thanked Republican Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she of course a Democrat from New York, for urging the FDA to speed up approvals of new, more effective sunscreen ingredients. A bipartisan bill is pending in the House that would require the FDA to allow non-animal testing. DeRue said Bimotrizenol could secure FDA approval by the end of 2025. If it does, he said, it would be the most vetted, safest sunscreen ingredient on the market. As Congress and the FDA debate, many Americans have taken to importing their own sunscreens from Asia or Europe, despite the risk of fakes. The sunscreen issue has gotten people to see that you can be unsafe if you're too slow, said Alex Tabarrok, a professor of economics at George Mason University. The FDA is just incredibly slow. They've been looking at this now literally for 40 years. Congress has ordered them to do it, and they still haven't done it. Now, you can order overseas versions of sunscreens from online pharmacies such as Coco Center in France. Keep in mind that the same brands may have different ingredients if sold in U.S. stores, but importing your sunscreen may not be practical. The best sunscreen is the one that you will use over and over again, so said New York City dermatologist Jane Yu. Now to an article asking, how effective are blue light glasses? They might not cut strain, but they may add screen use. Ann Kaufman writes this for USA Today. As our lives move increasingly online, the number of minutes a day we spend staring at laptops, phones, and tablets has skyrocketed. In response, many have taken to donning a pair of lenses specifically designed to block out the blue light emitted from our screens. But are they really effective? And how damaging is blue light anyway? Here's what the experts had to say. Do blue light glasses really work? Well, they mostly don't work for the things that they're advertised for, says Craig C., an ophthalmologist with the Cleveland Clinic. Blue light glasses are largely marketed as a solution to eye strain and as a protectant for the retina. Their effectiveness is not backed up, though, by science, however. While they are successful in blocking blue light is not necessarily something that needs to be filtered out for ocular health. At this point in time, there's really not enough science or evidence to support or deny the benefits of disease-causing problems with blue light, so says Dr. Ronald Benner, president of the American Optometric Association. He calls studies on the subject contradictory and inconclusive. Blue light, which is a low wavelength and high energy, does behave differently on the eye. C says in large doses, it can cause harm to the retina. However, as Benner points out, screens are not a unique example of blue light exposure. Indirect sunlight by itself produces 25 times the blue light a typical screen does. Indirect sunlight produces 250 times as much. Still, blue light can suppress our natural melatonin production, making it hard to sleep if there's an increased screen exposure at night. So while the glasses will not protect you from long-term retina damage and may not safeguard against eye strain, they can be a useful tool for the screen, especially if you use it in the evenings. Well, how exactly do blue light glasses work? Blue light glasses work by reflecting the light waves coming in so they bounce off the surface. There's a coating or filter on the lens that reflects the wavelength or blue spectrum of light, preventing it from coming through. What are the benefits or negatives of blue light glasses? One potential benefit could be better sleep. High energy blue light, when it hits the retina, stimulates cells in the brain, essentially turning them on, Benner says. In the evening times, having the blue light filter on and blocking that so that we're not suppressing the melatonin production might be a beneficial aspect, he says. That's a concern that also could be addressed by limiting exposure. Both Benner and C advise shutting off the screens before bed. As for negatives, Benner says there is probably very little direct harm, but reminds us that we're not sure about the benefits yet. Well, how about using blue light glasses as computer glasses? If your eyes are struggling with prolonged contact with screens, there may be another answer. The thought is not so much that screens start to bother our eyes because of the blue light. What is much more likely is that the eyes get dry, C says. When we focus on something, we stop blinking so much and our eyes get dry, creating strain. He recommends the 20-20-20 rule as a remedy. Every 20 minutes, look at something 20 feet away for about 20 seconds. That gives your eye a break. Eye muscles are fatigued just like leg muscles are fatigued, Benner says. Some blue light glasses do have a plus one prescription on their lens, which helps with up close focus, C says. That part may be helpful. Do blue light glasses help with headaches? Like with other purported benefits to the frames, there is not enough evidence to strongly confirm this claim. If you're getting headaches while staring at screens, the first thing I would recommend is people seek out their local optometrist to get their eyes checked, Benner advises. It may be that you're experiencing a focusing issue or an uncorrected astigmatism. Blue-blocking lenses may help with fatigue, he says, and anti-glare filters can do the same, but a persistent problem should be addressed with a doctor. Is it okay to wear blue light glasses every day? Well, there's no evidence to suggest that blue light glasses are doing harm, so wearing them every day will not likely be a detriment to your health. That said, if you experience headaches or other bothersome symptoms related to your sight, your first stop should be the optometrist's office. What is macular degeneration? Well, macular degeneration is a condition in which a small part of the back of the eye that focuses on facial recognition and reading is damaged and vision becomes greatly inhibited. That part of the eye has a very specific design, and if it is altered, vision can become significantly impaired. Smoking is a big factor in macular degeneration, Brenner says, but blue light is more of a question mark. While it could increase macular degeneration and cataract development, the studies have been inconclusive and basically contradictory at times, he explains. And more for USA Today, and today being May the 20th, 2024. This article is entitled, Biden Tells Graduates of Extremist Forces, President Lays Out Stakes in Morehouse Speech. This article is written by Joey Garrison and Maya Homan. President Joe Biden on Sunday warned graduates at one of the country's most revered African-American academic institutions of extremist forces aligned against the meaning and message of Morehouse College in a commencement address that sought to lay out the stakes of the 2024 election. Graduates, this is what we're up against, Biden said during a 27-minute speech that leaned heavily into the themes of faith and democracy in an appeal to black voters. They peddle a fiction, a character about what being a man is about. Tough talk, abusing power, bigotry. Their idea of being a man is toxic. But that's not you, and it's not us, Biden said. Biden's remarks to the 414 graduates at Morehouse, an all-male historically black college in Atlanta, came as he is struggling to unite black voters, particularly black men, around his candidacy. Many Morehouse students and faculty criticized Biden's participation when it was announced because of his support for Israel's war in Gaza. In a democracy, we debate dissent about America's role in the world. I want to say this very clearly. I support peaceful, nonviolent protest, Biden said on Sunday in response to the complaints. Your voices should be heard. I promise you, I hear them. No major disruptions, but peaceful protests target Biden. Although there were no major disruptions during Biden's speech, A few students did walk out when Biden received an honorary Morehouse degree. More than a dozen graduates and at least three faculty members wore keffiyehs, while one student entered the ceremony draped in a Palestinian flag. As Biden delivered his address, at least one female faculty member stood in the opposite direction, her fist raised in a sign of protest. Biden, wearing a maroon gown at the outdoor ceremony, said his administration is working around the clock for more than just one ceasefire, but also to bring the region together. He reiterated his support for a two-state solution in which Israelis and Palestinians live in peace. This is one of the hardest, most complicated problems in the world. There's nothing easy about it, Biden said. I know it angers and frustrates many of you, including my family, but most of all, I know it breaks your heart. It breaks mine as well. Biden added that leadership is about fighting through the most intractable problems to find a solution by doing what you believe is right, even when it's hard and lonely. About a mile away, pro-Palestinian protesters held a rally organized under the banner of Say No Genocide, Joe speaking at Morehouse. Morehouse's valedictorian also raised Israel's war in Gaza during his remarks before Biden took the lectern. It is my stance as a Morehouse man, nay, as a human being, to call for an immediate and the permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, graduating senior D'Angelo Jeremiah Fletcher said, with Biden sitting just steps behind him. Biden applauded in response. Biden touts record with black voters. Polling shows Biden is vastly underperforming his 2020 performance among black voters, a reliably Democratic constituency, as some drift to Donald Trump, the former president and presumptive Republican nominee. A New York Times Siena College poll of six battleground states, including Georgia, found Biden had support from 60% of black voters and Trump, while Trump is backed by 20% of black voters. Biden won black voters in 2020 election by an 87-12 margin, that according to the exit polls. Ahead of Biden's arrival, Anwar Karim, a sophomore, studying film at Morehouse and a member of Atlanta University Center Students for Justice in Palestine, told USA Today he was disappointed in his school's choice for a commencement speaker. He also decried Morehouse's decision to award Biden an honorary degree, which is typically awarded to the school's commencement speaker after a faculty vote. Morehouse College is dedicated to producing men of consequence who lead lives of service and leadership. And I just have to beg the question, when it comes to Biden, what is an example of his leadership, Karim said Friday. Biden commits to showing democracy is still the way. In his speech, Biden touted his presidency as one that has delivered to black Americans, pointing to the efforts to invest in black families and communities, cut child poverty, expand work opportunities, reduce prescription drug prices, and cut student loan debt. He called out the poison of white supremacy and systemic racism. He said he is committed to show that democracy is still the way, even in the face of inequality for black Americans. What is democracy if black men are being killed in the street? What is democracy if the trail of broken promises still leave black communities behind, Biden said. What is democracy if you have to be 10 times better than anybody else to get a fair shot? Most of all, what does it mean, as you've heard before, to be a black man who loves his country, even if it doesn't love him back in equal measure? Biden rallied against new voting restrictions in Georgia and the constant attack on black election workers. He also said those who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, are called patriots by some, a clear reference to Donald Trump. Not in my house, Biden said. In the days leading up to his Morehouse visit, the White House focused on black outreach. Biden met on Thursday with plaintiffs of the landmark Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision that on the 70th anniversary of the dismantling of the separate but equal precedent. On Friday, Biden met with leaders of the Divine Nine, HBCU sororities, and fraternities. In Atlanta on Saturday, Biden spoke to Morehouse alumni and others at a campaign event at Mary Mack's Tea Room. The fact is, this election, lots at stake, lots at stake. It's not about me, it's about the alternative as well, Biden said. My opponent's not a good loser, but he is a loser. Introducing Biden, Morehouse President David Thomas said, no administration in history since the inception of historically black colleges and universities has invested more in our institutions than the Biden administration. And if you look at his policies, it's very clear that those investments are not charity, Thomas said. Biden is 81. He closed his remarks with a reference to his age, a liability that has hung over his reelection. When he started his political career, Biden said he was told he was too young. Now he hears that he's too old. Well, whether you're young or old, I know what endures. The strength and wisdom of faith endures. And my challenge to you is to still keep the faith as long as you can, Biden said. Together, we are capable of building a democracy that will be more than worthy of our dreams. And we continue with today's USA Today, and this article is entitled, Israel Pounds Gaza as Netanyahu Gets an Ultimatum. Susan Miller writes this for USA Today. Israeli forces launched heavy strikes against Gaza on Sunday, hours after a top Israeli official gave Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu an ultimatum to figure out a post-war vision for the embattled enclave. Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz demanded that Netanyahu agree to a plan, one that would specify who would rule Gaza after the war with Hamas ends. Do that by June 8th, or Gantz and his centrist party would bolt the war coalition. The demands by Gantz, a retired general, show the latest fracture among Israel's top leaders. On Wednesday, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant also pushed Netanyahu for clarity on post-war Gaza. Gantz released a six-point plan that would allow Israel to retain security control of Gaza, but bring a temporary U.S.-European-Arab-Palestinian system of civil administration over the enclave. It would also require equitable national service for all Israelis, including ultra-Orthodox Jews who are now exempted from the military draft. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was scheduled to meet with Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders on Sunday. Sullivan was expected to push the longtime U.S. ally to pursue Hamas in a more targeted way, particularly in the southern city of Rafah, where thousands have been fleeing after more than 1 million displaced Palestinians sought shelter there from fighting in the north. Sullivan met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to discuss an almost finalized draft of a deal between Washington and Riyadh, the Saudi state news agency said on Sunday. The discussions target U.S. security guarantees and a civilian nuclear cooperation pact, that according to Rutgers. They came amid reports that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are nearing an agreement that could allow Saudi Arabia to recognize Israel for the first time and possibly carve a pathway to Palestinian statehood, which Netanyahu has resisted. Fierce fighting in central and northern Gaza. At least 28 Palestinians were killed Sunday, most in a strike on a house in Nezeri in central Gaza, Gaza health officials and Hamas said. The Gaza Civil Emergency Service said rescue teams also have recovered the bodies of 150 Palestinians killed by the army in recent days, and that 300 houses had been struck by Israeli aerial and ground fire. Fighting raged anew in northern Gaza as Israeli forces advanced into the narrow alleyways of Jabalia on Sunday. That amid fears that Hamas was reestablishing a foothold in areas that had been cleared earlier in the war. The Israeli military said it was operating to identify armed terrorist cells and conducting dozens of strikes that to assist the forces operating on the ground in the Jabalia area. That's the largest of Gaza's 8 historic refugee camps. Israeli forces recover body of hostage Ron Binyan. The Israeli military said Saturday it recovered the body of Ron Binyamin, who was among the 252 people seized by Hamas-led Palestinian gunmen back in October on the 7th. Chief military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said Binyamin was found along with 3 other slain hostages, whose repatriation was announced on Friday. Citing intelligence information, the military said all had been killed on October the 7th. The 3 other hostages, Shani Luke, who was 23, Amit Beskilia, 28, and Yitzhak Gallanter, 57, were attacked by Hamas while at the Nova Music Festival. Netanyahu reiterated a pledge to return all the remaining hostages. And continuing with USA Today, misery in Houston, power is out, and the heat is rising. It's the title of this article, and it's written by Dinah Boyers-Pulver. Hundreds of thousands of Texans continued to swelter in unrelenting heat and humidity on Sunday as utility workers tried to restore electricity that 3 days after a derecho and a few tornadoes slammed the Houston areas, leaving 7 dead. The heat index, what the temperature feels like, is expected to increase in Houston region each day through the first half of the week, reaching into the triple digits on Tuesday and Wednesday. The largest electricity provider in the region, CenterPoint Energy, estimates that 80% of its 2.6 million customers would have power restored by Sunday night. The Weather Service warned Sunday that intense summer-like heat will continue across the central U.S., then from southern Texas into the southern high plains on Monday and Tuesday, with possibly record-breaking temperatures soaring into the triple digits. Houston storm toppled high-voltage towers. The city of Houston posted on X Sunday morning that besides the restoration of electricity, its priorities would focus on providing ice, water, and cooling centers for affected residents. The storm toppled high-voltage towers and trees and took out electrical lines throughout the region, causing an estimated $5 billion or more in damage. On Saturday night, CenterPoint Energy said more than 2,000 employees and 5,000 contractors were working in the region. They expect to have storm-related restoration substantially completed by Wednesday evening. Prioritizing key public safety facilities such as hospitals, police and fire departments, and water treatment plants, the company stated it restored about 60% of the outages, more than 550,000 customers, that in the first 48 hours after the storm. "We have made progress overnight, but there is still more work to be done." The company posted that on X Sunday morning. Crews, including the Mutual Assistance Support, are rolling out across the city to continue the work of getting power back on to the remaining impacted customers. On Saturday, Leni Wilson, the company's senior vice president for electric business, said, "We understand the higher temperatures we are experiencing across Houston and the surrounding communities make getting the lights and air conditioning back on even more important." Electricity also remained out on Sunday for about 3,800 customers in western Louisiana, which caught a piece of Thursday evening storms. Now, in addition to the powerful straight-line winds that battered southeast Texas, the Weather Service has confirmed at least 2 tornadoes including an EF1 with winds of 86 to 110 miles per hour, that near Pine Island, Texas. And there was another tornado near Cypress, Texas, that in Harris County. What is a derecho? A derecho is a widespread windstorm associated with bands of rapidly moving showers or thunderstorms that may be referred to as bow echoes or squall lines. A derecho can produce destruction similar to a tornado, but the damage typically occurs in one direction along a relatively straight path that's referred to as straight line wind damage. That's according to the Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center. By the Weather Service's definition, derecho wind damage extends at least 400 miles and is at least 60 miles wide, with gusts of more than 58 miles per hour along most of its length, but also with pockets of winds higher than 75 miles per hour. The word derecho was first used by Gustav Hendricks, a physics professor at the University of Iowa, to illustrate the difference between such wind storms and tornadoes. That is according to the Storm Prediction Center. And crash imperils Iranian president. Weather hinders getting to the site where the copter went down. George Ortiz writes this for USA Today. The lives of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his foreign minister were feared to be in jeopardy after their helicopter crashed Sunday in heavy fog in a mountainous area. That was following a visit to the country's northwest border. A massive search and rescue effort is currently going on. And that will conclude this, the first hour of USA Today. And again, this is Monday, and it is the 20th of May, 2024. My name is Mary McConnell. Thank you.